it is a great honor to be giving this lecture. For me, I mean, it's a great honor in and of itself, but it's a great honor for me personally for two reasons. The first was that I was a student in international history at the LSC 15 years ago. I did what was then the MSc, which I gather now you have a choice of an MA or an MSc in international history, but I did the master's in international history here, and it was an absolutely fantastic year. It was one of the best years of my life. I know that's a cliche, but it really was. I met my wife while I was studying here, but it just intellectually being at the LSC was just wonderful, and I loved studying here. Ironically, I'm an Americanist. I'm an international historian. I do U.S. foreign policy, but I'm predominantly an Americanist. And the irony was that I came to LSC from Toronto. I'm Canadian to study British imperial history and British intelligence history in the early 20th century, and I took a class with Yussi Hanamaki, who now teaches in Geneva, and that converted me. Coming to London basically turned me on to doing U.S. foreign policy. It was Yussi's class. LSC has changed a lot in the intervening years. The class that Yussi taught in the basement of a building, I forget what it was called, but it's the one that's no longer there.
Yeah, Phillips and Fermi.
Yeah, that's now basically a construction zone, from what I can tell, for a new student center. And this building wasn't LSE's when I was here, this fantastic building. So a lot has changed at LSE, but I love coming back here, and it's a great honor as a former student to be able to come back and to give this lecture. It's a great personal honor for another reason, too. The very first conference paper I ever gave was when I was a graduate student. I was doing my PhD, and I gave it in this conference series back in 2000 when it was just UCSB. And I went to Santa Barbara to give a paper on Canadian peacemaking or peacemaking attempts during the Vietnam War, which wasn't my dissertation topic, but was something I was interested in as a Canadian. And I gave a paper on Canadian attempts to bring an early end to the Vietnam War in 1964, 65, and 66. And it was, in the fashion that happens at these conferences, very gently but very expertly torn apart by the commentator. Who pointed out all of it, a guy by the name of Kirk Dorsey, who I'm sure a lot of you know and teaches at the University of New Hampshire, who's the loveliest man. And he basically proceeded to tear apart the paper in the best possible way, in the most substantive possible way. And then I used those criticisms and some criticisms. And the discussion that followed in that conference and talking to other students at that conference, and I significantly improved the paper, and it eventually was published in Diplomatic History. It was one of my first journal articles. So this conference is a great opportunity, as you know, for students to present their work, to improve it, and then to go on and turn it into a dissertation chapter or to publish it as a journal article. Back then, it was called the CAWIG Conference, which I gather is not an acronym that Santa Barbara uses anymore. It was the Cold War. I think CAWIG, C-O-W-H-I-G, stood for, or is Celine, stood for Cold War International. Right. Now it's just much more elegant, CCWS. But that was a real formative experience in my professional career. And so not only as a former student of the LSC, but as a former participant in this conference back in one of its first years running, it's a great honor for me to present. The growth of the conference to include George Washington and the London School of Economics is extremely impressive. This is a much bigger conference than it was when I participated in it. And it's now, as you all know, the leading venue for graduate students doing post-war international history on the Cold War, but also some other things that touch on the Cold War. So it's just an absolutely wonderful venue that has expanded quite a bit. I myself have changed a lot in that time, too. I began as a scholar of the Vietnam War, looking at McGeorge Bundy and American decision-making in the escalation of the Vietnam War, looking at third-party peace initiatives, especially Canada, but not just Canada. And I've since expanded my repertoire to include religion, which is going to be the subject of my lecture today. More specifically, I look at how religion has influenced the conduct of American foreign policy. And I've just published a book on this subject that goes back to the colonial period and finishes the last chapter. There's an epilogue that deals with Obama and George W. Bush. But the last substantive chapter deals with Ronald Reagan and the end of the Cold War. So it's a book that covers a huge sweep of time, but I do have 8 chapters on the Cold War because the Cold War was not only an important episode in American foreign policy history, which is the main focus of the book, but it was also a time of great religious ferments and developments in the United States and in the rest of the world. As you'll have noticed from the title of my lecture, given my own interests, and given the focus of this conference, today I'm going to talk about the religious Cold War. And I'm going to use the United States as my main example, but I'll try and touch on other regions as well. And what I'm hoping is that I can stimulate discussion from people who specialize in other areas of the world that I don't, where we can talk more about what the religious Cold War might look like. I can certainly provide examples from the United States, and obviously a lot of those examples touch on other regions of the world, but I'm not a specialist in that. So what I was hoping to do is to provoke ideas from you, from the audience, from you guys, to see if we can talk about a religious Cold War, as I'm going to be doing in the next little while. I'll begin by explaining what I mean by the title. What exactly was the religious Cold War, or rather, what do I mean by the phrase the religious Cold War? I'll then call attention to the surprising lack of attention that it's received from scholars of the Cold War, and I'm actually somewhat grateful that Arne is not here, because like people did last night, I'm going to take a pot shot at the Cambridge history of the Cold War. Before I point to some, and he's heard it all before, so he's glad he's not here too. Before pointing to some possible ways in which we can envision religion as a key element in the Cold War, not as a new master narrative or as the sort of the most important factor in the Cold War, I don't think you can make that argument about religion, but certainly as an important element that's been largely neglected, that I think really fleshes out and really complicates and enriches our understanding of the Cold War as a whole. That's the argument I make about American foreign policy in my book, but I think it can be applied to the Cold War in general. So, what was the religious Cold War? I think we do just as well to speak not simply of religion and the Cold War, or of religion in the Cold War, but of the religious Cold War, because matters of faith permeated the conflict, particularly certain episodes, to the extent that they often helped define the ideological struggle between the United States and the Soviet Union, between West and East, and in a lot of occasions, as far as I can tell, between the global, what we might call the global North and the global South. I'd propose that we can speak of the religious Cold War just as we speak of a cultural Cold War or of an economic Cold War. None purports to tell the whole story, but a significant aspect of the Cold War. And I would also propose that we can tell a story, though I'd be cautious to say not the story of the Cold War through a religious lens. And that's what I'll try to do shortly in this lecture. But before I get to that, why was religion such a predominant feature of the Cold War? Religion was a major facet of previous conflicts in international history, but what was it about the Cold War that allowed religion to flourish, as I would argue, like never before, or at least not for a long, long time? Why did it flourish in a modern era in which science was paramount? Indeed, most Cold Warriors in the West believed that modernization would lead to secularization. Following Karl Marx, Max Weber, Sigmund Freud, three very different thinkers, Cold War intellectuals like the Rostow brothers, the sociologist Daniel Bell, Richard Hofstadter, and many others believed that religion was a pre-modern impulse that could not survive in the modern world. And this, of course, is the secularization thesis. As late as 1960, Daniel Bell pronounced in his book The End of Ideology, the end of the political influence of evangelicalism in the United States. And he said that, and he specifically mentioned, and I quote, the end of evangelicalism's high emotionalism, its fervor, enthusiasm, and excitement, its revivalism, and its peculiar schizoid character. And the tenor that one gets from reading The End of Ideology is that religion was peripheral to American politics. It was marginal, and it was unimportant. Bell and American and European intellectuals explained away the continuing religiosity of the United States, which, of course, was a big problem for the secularization thesis because it was the most modern society on Earth, as an aberration of American exceptionalism. And you see that all in the literature on the secularization thesis. Why is the United States so religious? And basically people would say, well, it's American exceptionalism. Just as they would say, why is there no socialism in the United States? Why is there no this? Why is there that? Oh, it's American exceptionalism. The United States is just different. We now know just how wrong Daniel Bell really was, and that within a few years, American evangelicalism would begin a surge that would catapult it from subculture to mainstream and from the margins of political power to its very center. And today, with ultra-modernizing and globalizing nations like China, Brazil, South Korea, and many, Turkey, and many others, increasingly embracing religion, and also increasingly embracing very conservative forms of religion. They're not just embracing religion, but religiosity. Very conservative forms of Islam, of Christianity, like Pentecostalism, and very conservative Catholicism. We also now know that it's secular Western Europe that's the exception in a world of faith, not the United States. When, at least when we talk about the secularization thesis, we shouldn't talk about American exceptionalism. We should talk about European exceptionalism. And in fact, one could argue that the Cold War itself helped facilitate this process by promoting high modernist, statist, secular solutions to the world's social and economic problems, by promoting vast modern social projects that aimed to break with tradition, including religious tradition. Planners throughout the world antagonized religious communities, and when these modern projects failed, as they often did, religion and traditional society struck back. This happened in lots of places. It happened in Iran, where the Shah's white revolution triggered a wave of unrest and disquiet that helped stimulate Shiite fundamentalism. It happened in the United States, where the liberalism of Kennedy's New Frontier and Johnson's Great Society paved the way for Jerry Falwell and the moral majority. And it happened elsewhere in the Middle East and Africa. But what else was it about the Cold War that afforded religion a role in an otherwise geopolitical contest? I would argue that it was the very structural nature of the Cold War itself that provided an environment that allowed religion to flourish. As everyone here knows, I'm getting over a cough, so I'm going to take advantage of the water. So it was the very structural nature of the Cold War itself that allowed religion and other cultural, other aspects of culture to flourish and to influence geopolitics. The devastation of total war in World War II and the emergence of nuclear weapons made great power war unpalatable, even unthinkable, although there were times, of course, when the great powers came close to nuclear war. But as both Anne and Matthew reminded us last night, they didn't go to war. How could you win the Cold War? How could either side win the Cold War? Not through force alone, despite what people like Herman Kahn and Henry Kissinger said, but through other means. By waging the Cold War not through military means, but through culture, propaganda, espionage. And of course, we all think of the Cold War as the epitome, or as a time when culture, propaganda, espionage were in their heyday and reached a high watermark in their influence in geopolitics. These other means included the power of ideas, these non-military means of waging the Cold War. Doubly so, considering that the Cold War coincided with other historical phenomena like decolonization, human rights, social and racial justice that made legitimacy a key determinant of geopolitical success. And I think we need a lot more work on the concept of legitimacy, not just human rights, but on legitimacy as an organizing principle that really fundamentally changes the way people think about geopolitics and think about international relations in general. And this is something that's very much part of the Cold War, but also, touching back on last night's discussion, also separate from the Cold War. And of course, within the realm of ideas, within the realm of culture, religion is extremely important and influential. And here's where I think we can learn from anthropologists, going back to Geertz and onwards, looking at religion as a cultural system. Most of the world went through a religious revival at some point during the Cold War. Not all of the world, but certainly a lot of the world did. And religion as culture, and culture then as politics, ended up having a profound influence on geopolitics. I'd now like to use the United States and U.S. foreign policy and U.S. religious domestic politics in the United States as a way to illustrate the religious Cold War in action. As I said before, this is my own field. This is the topic that I know best. But I'd like this to provide something of a model for other countries, not exactly in the trajectory that I'm going to be discussing it, but certainly as a model to look at the way, perhaps a flawed model, I'm sure, but certainly as a way to think about linking religion to the Cold War. First, it's worth noting that until very recently, I would say in the last 10 years or so, scholars had almost completely ignored the role of religion in international history. Religion did not appear in the major overviews or historiographical guides in my field in American diplomatic history, those volumes edited by Tom Patterson and Michael Hogan and others, and Bob Schultzinger. None of those historiographical guides, methodological guides, theoretical surveys of how to do American foreign relations history include religion. which is incredible, especially when you look at the breadth of the themes and concepts that are otherwise covered. Everything in the cultural turn, of course, lots on economics, lots on national security and domestic politics, but nothing on religion. And I was very surprised when the three volumes of the Cambridge History came out, which, of course, is a landmark piece of scholarship, book of scholarship, involving a lot of people doing fantastic work. And it's my go-to resource now whenever I want to consider something on the Cold War, especially if it's not within my specific area of expertise. There's no chapter in the Cambridge History. In those three volumes of the Cambridge History, there's no chapter on religion. There are some chapters on Islam or on the greater, what we might call the greater Middle East, that touch on religion. But there's no single chapter in the Cambridge History that looks at religion, even though there are chapters that look at culture, that look at economics, that look at national security. In fact, a lot of those concepts have multiple chapters, as you'd expect, to look at economics in various time periods of the Cold War, to look at culture or race in various time periods of the Cold War. There's a chapter in the Cambridge History on the biosphere in the Cold War, which I think is a perfectly valid and legitimate topic. But I think it's odd that when you consider the Cold War, you could consider the biosphere, but you would not consider religion. And that's not unique to the Cambridge History. That's actually quite typical for major surveys of the Cold War and also of international relations history, and I should say international relations theory. That's beginning to change now, and I have my own arguments as to why this is beginning to change. I actually think it has a lot to do with 9/11 and how 9/11 stimulated interest in religion and geopolitics. That's certainly a large part of how I came to be interested in religion and American foreign policy. 9/11 caused me to look at American foreign policy and international relations and religion, in religion's role in both of those subjects in a new way. Whatever the reason, over the past decade, there's been a steady flow of works exploring various aspects of religion's role in international history, especially the world wars and the Cold War, as well as the foreign policies of specific countries. And nowadays, until about 2005, 2006, before that, if you picked up a copy of Diplomatic History, the flagship journal in the study of American foreign policy history, you'd be hard-pressed to find articles on religion. There were some, but they were very, very sporadic and very rare. Nowadays, when you pick up a copy of DH and look at the table of contents, usually there's a chapter, or an article rather, on religion. So religion has re-emerged or has entered into the field in a big way. Cold War History, the Journal of Cold War Studies, the International History Review, I'm noticing that religion is popping up more and more in the articles published by these journals as well. This is all to the good, for it not only helps us understand our past, but also, given the growth of religion in almost every region of the world today, our present and future as well. Thankfully, neglect no longer seems to be the problem. Historians of the Cold War, and not just historians of religion in the Cold War, are acknowledging the importance of the topic more frequently and in greater numbers. International relations theory, which also neglected religion, has recently shown signs of doing the same. There was a terrific book published about a year and a half ago by Dan Philpott, Monica Toft, and Tim Shaw called God's Century, about religion and international relations theory and international relations history in the 20th century, and I highly recommend it to you. Scholars of many disciplines now recognize that religion was a factor throughout the Cold War, from its origins in the division of early post-war Europe to the collapse of communist rule in the Soviet Union just over four decades later. Long mired in obscurity, religion in the Cold War is now an important aspect, I would argue, of international history. So, to use the United States, what would a religious history of the Cold War look like? What would a religious history of containment look like? And even though I think this has applications for the rest of the world, I will admit at the outset that this is easier to do for the United States because the United States was and still is a very religious country, a country in which religion is at the forefront of domestic politics and also at the forefront of American foreign policy. It's not difficult to find examples. We can argue about how much causal force those examples have or had in American diplomatic history, but it's easy to find examples. So it might be easier to do this for the United States than for some other countries. So what would a religious history of containment look like? I think it would begin with Franklin Roosevelt, as I think the Cold War does as well, to some extent, and certainly with a lot of irony. But it would begin with FDR and FDR's use of religious liberty in framing the world crisis. Franklin Roosevelt, from 1937 onwards, from the outbreak of the Sino-Japanese War in July 1937, was convinced that the United States had to play a greater role in resisting fascism and Nazism and Japanese militarism. But his main problem was in how to convince the American people, who were overwhelmingly opposed to playing that greater role, how to convince the American people to do so. And the astonishing thing is he turned to religion as much, if not more, than any other topic. And he had to, because Nazi Germany or Imperial Japan were not going to attack the continental United States. And isolationists and anti-interventionists had a very easy argument to make in arguing that the United States had to stay out of the war, because as Herbert Hoover said this time and time and time again, and Hoover was not a nativist, anti-Semitic, provincial isolationist like a Father Coughlin or a Gerald Nye or a Charles Lindbergh or somebody like that. Hoover was a committed internationalist. And Hoover said we should not get involved in this. We should remain firmly neutral because there's no way we're under threat here. There's no way we're going to be attacked by any of these countries. We have what international relations theorists, but not Hoover, call free security. And so this was one of FDR's problems. And Franklin Roosevelt, in trying to overcome this problem and trying to overcome isolationism at home, as well as to conceive of the world crisis itself, turns to religion. And he did so in countless internal documents, and especially public speeches, and mostly speeches to non-religious audiences. So he would use religion to frame the world crisis, not just in speeches to churches or to religious groups where you would expect him to talk about religion, but he did so in otherwise secular settings. So in his 1939 State of the Union address, FDR began his 1939 State of the Union before Congress by saying that the Nazis were a threat to the three great institutions of civilization, in order of priority: religion, democracy, and international goodwill. And he put them very explicitly in that order of priority, because he said, without religion, you can't have democracy, and without democracy, you can't have international goodwill, international peace. It's what we now call democratic peace theory. And it's obviously, the democratic peace is a very old idea in political thought, going back to Montesquieu, to Kant, to others. And American thinkers were not unaware of the democratic peace. People like James Madison in 1795 were writing about the democratic peace, saying the republics don't go to war with one another, and he was picking up from Montesquieu. His innovation and the innovation of other American thinkers was to add religion to the democratic peace. So if you read Montesquieu or Kant, it's very free of religion. If you read Madison, Jefferson, and others, and Madison and Jefferson were not particularly religious men, they inject religion into the democratic peace because religion was the source of conscience, it was the source of morality, therefore it was the source of democratic politics. Because if the state can interfere with conscience and morality, it can interfere with anything. And FDR was very explicit about this. He said time again, including in his 1939 State of the Union, if you allow freedom of religion, you can't help but have democracy. If you really have true religious freedom and religious pluralism, you will have democracy. If you have democracy, you'll have international peace. The Nazis are a threat to these institutions, therefore they're going to, maybe they can't attack us now, but by attacking these great ideas, they're going to snuff them out in most of the world, and as he said a year later, the United States can't remain an island of democracy in a world ruled by force. 2 years later, in his 1941 State of the Union, he returned to and he did so in between in those 2 years and countless other more minor speeches. But in his 1941 State of the Union, he outlined what he called the Four Freedoms, which I'm sure everybody knows, the second of which was freedom of worship. And again, he returned to this idea that religion, which the Nazis were threatening, not just Judaism, but all religion, Judaism, Christianity, every type of religion, without freedom of worship, you would have international conflict. This is why the United States needed to get involved. In his October 1941 Navy Day address, which was 2 months before Pearl Harbor, and his most explicitly anti-German, most explicitly pro-war speech to date, that 1941 Navy Day address is centered around the idea that the Nazis were a threat to all religion, not just Christianity, not just Judaism. He said that the Nazis were looking to replace all religion with a Nazi pagan church, and Hitler would replace the cross with the swastika and the Bible with Mein Kampf. Shortly before the outbreak of the war, Franklin Roosevelt decided that he would try and arrange a summit of world faiths, a summit of the leaders of the world's great religions. And they would gather in Washington in 1940 or 41, and they would present a united front of people of conscience, morality, virtue, and faith against the dark forces of fascism and militarism and Nazism. And he tasked Adolf Burley, one of his key advisors on foreign policy, and also one of his point men on religion, on American, his sort of key liaison with American religious communities, to make it happen. And Burley didn't really know how to make it happen. He didn't know who the top Buddhist was or who the top Hindu was. And they spoke in this language. He told FDR, he said, "I don't know who the top Mohammedan is." And FDR said, "Well, go talk to the people who know this stuff. Go talk to the ambassadors from these countries." And so Burley paid a visit to the Turkish ambassador to Washington and pitched this idea to have a summit of world religious leaders. And the Turkish ambassador very embarrassingly sort of tried to dissemble a bit, and then finally said, "Mr. Burley, you see, I can tell you that my government would not be enthusiastic about this idea because we have a very strict constitutional separation of church and state, of mosque and state." And Burley thought about it and said, "Yeah, I guess that's true. I guess we do too. It's called the First Amendment." And so the idea came to nothing. But this is how seriously Franklin Roosevelt took the idea. It's also no coincidence that it was in the era of Franklin Roosevelt in the 1930s and 40s that the Judeo-Christian tradition was invented. This idea that Judaism and Christianity together are sort of two branches of the same religion, and that this Judeo-Christian identity that is equally Jewish as well as Christian is the source of true faith and is the source especially of democracy. This was a way to define the United States against threats abroad, but it was also a way to try and stave off right-wing radicalism at home, to try and stave off the brown shirts and the fascist movements that were beginning to gather pace at home, and also to discredit the anti-Semitic isolationists like Father Coughlin and Charles Lindbergh and Gerald Nye. Harry Truman inherited this religious vision of world politics and applied it to the Soviet Union. And here I see a real irony in the origins of the Cold War, because essentially what Harry Truman did is he took Franklin Roosevelt's strategy of arguing why the United States should take an active role in resisting Nazism and applied it to the Soviet Union. In Truman's speeches about the Soviet Union and about godless communism, you can almost take the exact same wording that Franklin Roosevelt used for Nazi Germany and just take out Nazi or Germany and put in Soviet or communist. And you'll get a good appreciation or a good sense of Harry Truman's view of the early Cold War. As Arne Westad reminds us in his book, and as he reminded us in his book, The Global Cold War, and as he reminded us yesterday, both sides could claim material progress and social justice. Both sides could claim modernization. Both sides could claim to have the true answer to material progress and try and win allies to their side. Harry Truman recognized that as well, and so did his advisors. They said they were very scared by this. They said the Soviets have development models and planning models and industrialization models and models of a certain type of democracy that are going to be very attractive to the rest of the world. And the Truman administration was quite worried about this. And Truman's answer to this was, but what they don't have, what the Soviets don't have, is religion. It's not just that they don't have Christianity. It's not just that they don't have the Judeo-Christian tradition, but they don't have religion. They are committed atheists, and they are committed to eradicating religion. And so when we think of a question like, was the Cold War inevitable? Why did the Grand Alliance break down, and why did these tensions emerge? I wouldn't suggest that religion provides the entire answer. But why is it that the United States and the Soviet Union came to see each other as implacable enemies, almost, you know, in a fairly short space of time? Why was the United States unable to trust the Soviet Union on an instinctive level, on a very ideological level? And I would argue that religion is a large part of that answer. And when you read the diaries and the letters and the memos and the speeches of people like James Forrestal and George Marshall to a lesser extent, Douglas MacArthur and others in this period, as well as Harry Truman, and as well as his point man to the Vatican and other religious groups, Myron Taylor, when you read what they wrote, it's obvious that religion mattered a great deal. It not only mattered a great deal to them personally, even though Truman liked to swear and play poker and wasn't a particularly pious man, but it mattered that the Soviets couldn't respect religion, therefore couldn't respect conscience and morality and virtue. And this, time and time again, we see this not only in the rhetoric of FDR about the Nazis, but also in the rhetoric and in the values and the private correspondence of Truman about speaking about the Soviets, of Eisenhower speaking about the Soviets, of Eisenhower, by the way, in the 50s, speaking about the French, saying that he was very worried about the decline of religious belief in France, because they said you cannot have virtue and you cannot have morality, you cannot have democracy, and therefore, if you have none of those, you cannot have peace without religious belief. Truman revived FDR's idea of having a summit of world religious leaders. He proposed it in the late summer of 1947, and I don't think it's a coincidence, and Truman himself was very explicit about this. In March, we had the Truman Doctrine, March 1947, and then in June, the announcement of the Marshall Plan. In July, Kennan's X article. In late July, the National Security Act, setting up the CIA and the NSC and the Department of Defense. And then Truman surveyed the world and said, "What? So we've set up all these, you know, we've laid in place all these building blocks for what would come to be called the Cold War, for waging, essentially, going on a war, permanent wartime footing without actually waging war. What are we missing?" And he said, "Well, we're missing something on faith. Not culture, not ideology, we're missing something on faith." And he tried to revive this idea of having this summit of world religious leaders, and he proposed it in 1947. And he asked Myron Taylor, who was the unofficial ambassador to the U.S. ambassador to the Vatican, so the United States and the Vatican didn't have official relations, official diplomatic relations. And he asked Myron Taylor to make it happen. And Taylor traveled to the Vatican to try and get the Vatican on board. The Vatican was quite enthusiastic about it. He sounded out other religious leaders. They were enthusiastic about it. What killed the idea was actually anti-Catholicism in the United States among Protestants. This is a story that Will Inboden tells very well in his book, Religion, Religion in the Cold War. Just a little side note on Inboden's book. This is one of the frustrations of working on your own books, and hopefully you don't have this problem in writing your dissertations. I was going to have a whole chapter on Myron Taylor and this idea of a religious summit in 1948. And I did a lot of research on it. I started writing it. I wrote thousands and thousands of words on it. It was going to be a chapter. I was very pleased with it. Inboden's book came out in 2008. He has a whole chapter on it, a very, very good chapter. And so all of a sudden, I didn't have a chapter on Myron Taylor and the Summit of World Religious Leaders. And it's now been relegated to, I think, three paragraphs or something like that. And I cite Inboden in each of those paragraphs. So it's one of those very frustrating things. But at the end, it kind of saved me because the book was already too long and it meant that I could cut some words. The Truman administration then applied religion in a variety of ways. I don't have time to get into the specifics to American foreign policy, whether it was using the USIA and religious propaganda to promote the American way of life, whether it was using religion through the Psychological Strategy Board and using open propaganda and then also covert propaganda, not only to promote the United States but to demonize the Soviet Union and other communists, whether it was supporting Christian democracy in Europe, whether it was working with the Catholic Church in the 1948 Italian elections, whether it was supporting church, trying to support, with not much success, churches behind the Iron Curtain, and rallying to the cause of Cardinal Mazzenti, and seeing his arrest as a major turning point in the deterioration of relations with the Soviet Union. And finally, also whether it was in trying to ally with other world faiths in fighting communism. Excuse me. And in 1949-50, J. Layton Stewart, the last American ambassador to China and a former missionary, former Presbyterian missionary to China, who spent most of his life in China, floated the idea of supporting Muslim Uyghurs in Western China and of arming them to fight the communists, just as the Carter and Reagan administrations would do with the Mujahideen against the Soviets in Afghanistan much later. Whether it was any of those, and also a lot of other initiatives I can't speak about, for the interest of time, religion was a major, not the most important, not the most consequential, but certainly an important aspect of Truman's vision of containment. Religion was also important in setting up some of the other aspects of American post-war foreign policy and also of international organizations. Excuse me. It wasn't just President Truman and the Truman administration who used religion to construct not just containment, but also the basis for the post-war world order. The Federal Council of Churches, which was the most important pan-Protestant super church organization in the United States, this large ecumenical organization, sponsored the Commission on a Just and Durable Peace during World War II, which was headed by John Foster Dulles. And they were the foremost and the most influential non-governmental organization to promote the UN, to promote an international organization that would be that would come to be called the UN, the United Nations, as a solution for world peace. Dulles and the Federal Council were in San Francisco in 1945. Dulles was a delegate to the U.S., was on the U.S. delegation, the official delegation, and he consulted with the Federal Council. He consulted with other religious organizations like the Foreign Missions Conference and the International Missions Conference in how to set up the UN and what this architecture and what the structure of the UN should look like. NGOs were invited to San Francisco to present their own views of world order and international organization. And again, a lot of these NGOs were church organizations, mostly from the United States and Europe. And the Federal Council, the World Council of Churches, the Foreign Missions Conference, especially through a guy called Frederick Nolde, were instrumental not only in founding the UN, but in supplying the language for the Human Rights Charter in 1948. And this idea of the dignity of the individual, which forms the basis, I would argue, of our whole conception of what human rights are. That's the, if you were to boil it down to one principle, it would be the dignity of the individual, is a Christian idea. And it becomes secularized in the 1940s, and especially in the late 1940s, and applied to a very, a religious idea gets applied to a very non-religious purpose. Dwight Eisenhower continued, even accentuated, Truman's religious approach in the revivalist 1950s, mostly through the same mechanisms, using propaganda, using psychological operations, supporting churches and the Vatican and other religious organizations, especially behind the Iron Curtain. I don't want to make too much of this, and other people have pointed this out, but I don't think it's a coincidence that in 1955 the U.S. was supporting four Christian leaders in mostly non-Christian Asia, noting Yemen, South Vietnam, and Ramon Magsaysay in the Philippines, although, of course, the Philippines was a Catholic country, both of whom were Catholic, and Syngman Rhee in South Korea and Chiang Kai-shek in Taiwan, both of whom were Methodists. And, of course, there was also John Foster Dulles there in the 1950s, who was promoting a very religious foreign policy for the United States. I think, actually, by the way, that Dulles has been misunderstood to a large extent. And I'm not saying Dulles' policies were right, but I think his reasons and how religion motivated his foreign policy has been misunderstood by historians, and I'd be happy to talk about that afterwards if anyone's interested. I think it's worth noting that FDR, Truman, and Eisenhower all shared a strikingly similar approach to religion. They all shared a belief in ecumenical, pragmatic, mainline Protestantism, with a particularly strong faith in the organic link between religion and democracy. This was the most common theme in speeches from FDR to Truman to Eisenhower, that without democracy you can't have religion, maybe in this, definitely in the Soviet Union or in China, but also, as Eisenhower said, and he got in a lot of trouble for saying this, in France. And he said in the 50s that he was worried France was becoming less democratic because it was becoming less religious. At the same time in the United States, you also had the emergence of a very broad-based, faith-based community of dissent against U.S. foreign policy. There were religious radicals like Dorothy Day and the Catholic Worker Movement and others who were staunchly opposed to containment, but you also had emerging in the very liberal establishment churches, people like Reinhold Niebuhr and people in his circle who had always supported U.S. foreign policy, adopting a very strident critique of containment and a very strident critique of America's reliance on nuclear weapons. We often think of the 50s as in the United States as a time of consensus, especially on foreign policy, which I think is actually not true in general. And we just think of McCarthyism, for one thing. But even beyond McCarthyism, I don't think there was a whole lot of consensus in the 1950s. But if we look at religious politics, and when we think of religion in the 50s, we think of it as consensual and monolithic, and just all they cared about was godless communism. Again, nothing could be further from the truth. And these religious dissenters were very influential and very very well connected, and were writing in the New York Times and the Washington Post and other places, and Time Magazine and Newsweek, and were providing a very stringent, very trenchant critique of containment, and pushing the Truman and Eisenhower administrations in directions they otherwise may not have gone. Not to say that Truman and Eisenhower adopted policies based on this critique, but it certainly kept them in line, which is one reason why I was so taken with Henry's argument about Catholic bishops in the early 1980s. I think that's something that is particularly true of the 1980s, but goes back through the Cold War, and it's something we need to dig deeper into. A sharp break came with John F. Kennedy and continued through to Jimmy Carter, in which American presidents no longer emphasized religion, no longer emphasized the Judeo-Christian tradition. And that idea completely drops off the radar for about 20 years. Kennedy's Catholicism, of course, was a major complication for him in the 1960 presidential campaign. He had to de-emphasize his Catholicism at a time when Catholicism was like Mormonism. In fact, it was even more, I would say, more controversial than Mitt Romney's Mormonism is today, I think, which is saying something. He had to de-emphasize his Catholicism, and as he said, he wanted to be a president who happened to be Catholic rather than a Catholic president. And so his sensitivity to the controversial nature of his religion led him to basically sideline all religion from foreign policy. It was a very conscious decision. And Kennedy, contra what FDR and Truman and Eisenhower had said time and time and time and time and time again, Kennedy repeatedly said, very deliberately and very explicitly, he said, quote, "Religion is not a weapon in the Cold War." You can find that phrase in several speeches verbatim. "Religion is not a weapon in the Cold War." The Kennedy administration didn't attack the Soviet Union on grounds of suppressing religious liberty. The Kennedy administration tried to kill Fidel Castro several times, but didn't make a whole lot of Castro's attacks on the Catholic Church, much to the Church's consternation in the United States. Other than because of the controversial nature of his own religion, Kennedy de-emphasized religion for four other reasons that I think are broader and have a lot more to do with larger developments aside from John F. Kennedy. These four reasons are: the 1960s was the era of separationism and secularism. This is where we see the privatization of faith, which secularism means the privatization of faith as well as the loss of faith. So this is the era of separationism, of separating church and state through Supreme Court decisions on school prayer, on birth control, on privacy, on obscenity. The era of separationism and secularism. The second reason is that it was the era, we've talked about this quite a bit, and we've seen some fabulous work in some of the papers so far on planning and development. This was the era of high modernism in the United States as well as elsewhere, when Walt Rostow and the modernization theorists came to town with secular problem-solving solutions to major problems rather than turning to religion. This is the era of detente. From 1963 onwards, the United States, and especially in the Kennedy administration, from his speech at American University in June 1963, wanted to work with the Soviets, didn't want to demonize the Soviets. And so, of course, in that era, and in the atmosphere of detente, religion had to take a back seat, because if you're going to emphasize religion in the Cold War and you're going to talk about the Soviet Union, there's only one way that conversation is going to go. So if you want to work with the Soviets, you have to de-emphasize religion. And the fourth reason why Kennedy and the Kennedy ministry, or rather why religion began to fade from American foreign policy in the 60s, is that some American allies, most especially South Vietnam, were now themselves guilty of infringing religious liberty. In South Vietnam, it was a Catholic president, Diem, against the Buddhists, which then culminated with the Buddhist revolt in May 1963, and eventually, it culminated with the overthrow of Diem. LBJ continued distancing religion from foreign policy, even though he himself was very personally devout and very personally close to Billy Graham and other religious leaders. At the same time, we had the emergence of civil rights and anti-war and anti-nuclear movements in the late 50s and through the 60s that were not entirely faith-based, but at least for white northerners and for liberals, began in a lot of cases in the churches. They either began in universities with young people, but for middle-aged, middle-class people, these protest movements began in the churches. The anti-Vietnam War movement, anti-nuclear, and civil rights movement. And so religion played a large role in the ferment of the 60s and in the changing parameters of American foreign policy in the 60s. And Jimmy Carter, much for the same reasons as Kennedy, deliberately sidelined religion from foreign policy. His own faith, his born-again baptism, was controversial, and so as his campaign advisors said, it was the weirdo factor. The more Carter talked about his religion, the worse off he would get. So he wanted to de-emphasize it. But Carter's own very staunch, very devout Baptist faith led him to strictly separate ideas of church and state. And I argue in my book that this led the Carter administration, it helped, not entirely, but helped lead the Carter administration to miss what was happening in Iran and to underestimate the power of this Shiite revolt, because, as I quote in the book, as I say in the book, as a CIA official said, who's going to take religion and politics seriously anyway? These are wild-eyed fanatics who don't really understand politics. We don't need to take them seriously. It wasn't until Reagan came into office that religion once again became a major part of American foreign policy. I don't have time to go into the many ways in which Reagan used foreign policy. We've also already heard a bit about that already. I would like to tell one story about Reagan before concluding. I think I've got a few minutes to do that before making some general concluding remarks. So the Reagan we remember is the Reagan of the Evil Empire speech to the National Association of Evangelicals, and that Reagan is certainly true, and that's a very important Reagan. But there was another Reagan who used a softer message of religious liberty and embraced Gorbachev's reforms when Gorbachev came to power. And Reagan was already looking for a Gorbachev before Gorbachev came to power, as a kind of way that as a wedge to open up Soviet society and to promote reform. And when Gorbachev came along promoting reform, Reagan embraced him because he thought, here's someone I can work with, and here's someone who's probably going to liberalize religion. And once he begins to do so, then he's not going to be able to stop reform in any other facet of Soviet society. And the most important story here, and it's one that I spend a lot of time in my book looking at, and it's one that it pops up in a couple of books, but really historians haven't looked at very much, is of a group of Siberian Pentecostals who took refuge in the American embassy in Moscow, who traveled from Siberia to Moscow, stormed their way into the U.S. embassy and claimed refugee status, claimed asylum, which was the nightmare scenario for both the Soviets and the Americans because it would introduce this tremendous complication. They did so in 1978. They burst in 1978, and Jimmy Carter wanted absolutely nothing to do with them. He didn't throw them out of the U.S. embassy because that would bring its own complications. So they lived in the basement of the U.S. embassy on mattresses on the floor. And they ended up being there for 5 years. And they became a cause celeb in the United States. Congressmen, media personalities, lots of people were campaigning for the Siberian Seven, including Ronald Reagan before he became president. And once he became president, he kept up the pressure and he wrote letters to the Siberian Seven that would be passed on through the U.S. ambassador to them, obviously. And he was sort of a champion of their cause. Once he became president, he was a little less bellicose with his rhetoric about them. But he still was very concerned about their faith. In early 1983, almost 2 years into his administration, into his presidency, Ronald Reagan held his very first private meeting with Anatoly Dobrynin, the Soviet ambassador. When I first read, I had to triple check in a number of books to see if that really was true. That Reagan's first private meeting with the Soviet ambassador came almost 2 years into his presidency, which I find just absolutely incredible. And George Shultz ushered Dobrynin in through, it was a secret meeting, ushered Dobrynin in through the White House basement so reporters wouldn't see them. They went up. Dobrynin had no idea what Reagan wanted to talk about. And the only three people present there were Dobrynin, Shultz, and Reagan. All three of them talk about it in their memoirs. And to DeBrinian's total bafflement and astonishment. And this is a guy who had been in America for 20 years already by this point. Reagan wanted to talk about the Pentecostals. That's it. Nothing else. And he wanted to know if something could be done about their situation, if they could be allowed to leave the Soviet Union to emigrate to America. And he promised DeBrinian that if that happened, he would not say a word about it. But he would take it as a sign of good faith on the part of the Kremlin. And then the Reagan administration remaining silent about this, about their emigration, would then, to the Kremlin, be a sign of Reagan's good faith. As a way to start, this is a way to sort of start toning down the Cold War. A lot of crises would happen later that year, the downing of the Korean airliner, Abel Archer, and other things, but Reagan was already looking for some way to kind of manage the Cold War, to bring things under control. And he wanted to use the Pentecostals as the first confidence-building measures, the first kind of CBM that would lead to this process. And that's exactly what happened. It took a while. It took 6 or 7 or 8 months or so, if not more. I'm trying to remember the chronology. But the Moscow allowed the Pentecostals quietly to emigrate first to Israel, which, of course, was a common trail for refuseniks, to go to Israel first, where it would be less conspicuous, and then they could move to America, which is exactly what happened. And they were resettled in America. And conservative Republican congressmen then bombarded the Reagan administration with letters saying, this is great, wow, we've got such a propaganda victory. When are you going to have them to the White House? And Reagan said, I'm not. In fact, Reagan didn't say that. It was the second deputy assistant for East European Affairs who would answer Reagan's letters on this issue to senators and congressmen saying, we're actually not going to make a big deal of this because we don't really think it's that big a deal. But privately, the Reagan administration thought it was a very big deal. And so religious liberty and religion also is sort of part of the story of the end of the Cold War. What does this narrative reveal that I've just laid up from FDR to Reagan? I hope lots of things, but primarily I would argue that it reveals the ideological, some of, not all of, but some of the ideological underpinnings of America's Cold War. The use of religion, especially the promotion of religious liberty, corresponded precisely to the ebb and flow of Cold War tensions. Cold War tensions surge in the 1940s and 50s when Truman and Eisenhower are using religious liberty a lot. They sort of fade away in the era of détente, and then they rush back to the fore in the early 1980s with the Second Cold War. Causally, I'm not arguing that religion caused this ebb and flow of the Cold War, although I think the relationship is so close that it begs further investigation. And also on that note, it reveals, I would argue that my narrative reveals the importance of domestic politics in shaping national security policy, which I didn't have enough time to go into, and I'd be happy to answer questions about. I'd like to close just with a few very general remarks. The religious mapping of the Cold War has implications for other regions of the world, too. In fact, to varying degrees, I would wager that we could tell the story of the religious Cold War from almost any national perspective, except perhaps China or North Korea. Latin America's Cold War, I think, is there's already some really good work on Latin America's Cold War, and especially the Catholic Church, from liberation theology to the martyr church. I think there needs to be more work on Hinduism and Islam in South Asia, on religion in the Middle East, especially in the 1970s onwards, although Arne Gwestad, I think, does a tremendously good job of looking at political Islam in his book, The Global Cold War, and integrating it into the study of the Cold War as a whole. Buddhism, Hinduism, Islam, and Christianity in Southeast Asia, and in Africa as well, both North Africa and Sub-Saharan Africa. I'm not a specialist in these areas, but I know there's something there, just if only by America's religious interactions with these regions of the world. But from hearing the papers yesterday and today, where religion has popped up in quite a few of them, including two on the last panel, I'm sure there's more to the story there as well. None of this is to say that religion was the dominant factor in the Cold War. It was rarely determining, even in U.S. foreign policy in the late 1940s and early 1950s. There's only so much we can conclude causally by looking at religion. But to me, this isn't the point of reading and writing history. We're not social scientists parsimoniously looking for independent variables that caused everything to change or everything to happen. I was a joint poli-sci history major as an undergrad, and I dropped poli-sci for that very reason. Ironically, social and biological scientists are now making this case better than many historians in challenging the very basis of rational choice theory. There's a wonderful recent book by Jonathan Haidt called The Righteous Mind that really, I think, very effectively totally demolishes any kind of rational choice theory. This is not to say that people are irrational, only that they approach choices and then make decisions, not simply based on a dispassionate reading of the facts in front of them, but through an ideological and cultural prism that's taken decades to form. And here's where religion and other forms of culture and ideology can come into play. As historians, as messy as this process can be, our job is to explain why things happened in the manner they did. We're trying to piece together a puzzle, and to my mind, religion can provide some of the missing pieces. We have a general sense of what the puzzle looks like overall, but we need those missing pieces to get the full picture. And that's where the religious Cold War, integrated into general histories of the Cold War, can help put those pieces into place. Thank you.
Thank you. That was a fascinating overview. One that I think has given sort of hopefully should give plenty of us sort of pause for reflection and provoke lots and lots of questions. I'm slightly conscious of the time. Whereas if we let you slip by a quarter of an hour, and so we in other words give ourselves until half past, that will give us 25 minutes. Okay, great. So that gives us a little bit of time. I can't sort of give up the floor without throwing in one of the few lines in my lectures that is nearly guaranteed to get a laugh, which is an example which shows that even in what Andrew, I think, both provocatively but possibly accurately described as the European exception to the importance of religion in the Cold War, a reminder that even in European history, as a European specialist, it did sometimes matter. Mm. And this is my all-time favourite political campaigning slogan. This was something that appeared on the wall of opposite a polling booth in Sicily on the eve of the all-important April 1948 general election. In Italy, when Italy, as most of you will remember, faced a critical choice about whether or not it would vote for the left and the united socialist communist left, which was therefore largely irreligious, or the parties of the right, most notably the Christian Catholic democracy. And the slogan that appeared on the wall of the polling booth was on the wall of the building opposite was wonderful. It said, "In the privacy of the polling booth, Stalin can't see you, but God can." So even in European history, there is a room that's for
true.
A bit of...
That's true. I would say that the European exception is a post-1960s.
I think
you're absolutely right. Absolutely.
And even after that, it matters. But that's enough for me, but let's open the floor straight away to some questions. Jamie, you first.
Andrew, I'm very interested in... this sounds like such an open-ended question, but I'm very interested in how your books have been received in America. I mean, whenever I've been to America, the way in which religion just permeates the prism, as you said, at the end of the view, political matters, strikes me in the face all the time. I mean, it's for somebody who comes from a very non-religious background, it's something I can't really get my head around. But how is that affecting the way your book's being received there as opposed to the way that you...
Should we collect two or three, perhaps? We'll probably have several rounds of these, but yeah, great.
In your talk, you used the words frequently: Judeo-Christian, Christian, Catholic, religion. I don't think you once, though, used the word Jesus. So I'm wondering, does Jesus matter to them? I guess part of it is because, as you know, academics, we tend to be too cynical to believe that people could ever have an experience of the divine. And, you know, I wonder if, and in your book, you're actually very good when you talk about McKinley, and you talk about how academics tend to dismiss, this prayer he makes before he, decides to launch an invasion of the Philippines. And you take it seriously, but I guess what I'm trying to ask is, does divine spiritual experience, belief in Jesus actually matter to them? And one other point is that it seems to me that some of the debate, this dispute between the I mean, it's really can be traced in some ways to theological debates about what, you know, the most important components of Jesus' message was.
Okay, Zach, let's take three, and then Adam will round afterwards. But
if you wanted to explain why Kennedy's Catholicism was a more important issue than Romney's Mormonism is today, what events or trends would you point to help explain this change? Because it's something like today, a lot of Americans look at Mormonism as if it's like a sort of cult, and maybe having a weirdness factor second only to like Scientology.
Tom Cruise, the president. Yeah, okay. Should we take those first three?
Absolutely, yeah. There are three great questions, and yeah, as Jamie said, open-ended to just good and bad. And I'll try and be succinct. That's the bad part. If I'm not succinct, it's bad. So how has the book been received in America? Well, it's been received very well. it's interesting. I haven't had any academic reviews yet, and I think academics will treat the book differently. All the reviews so far have been in newspapers and on the radio and in popular press. And it's been, it's been generally well received. There have been a couple of criticisms that I think are very interesting. One is that it's too difficult to trace a causal influence from religion. I mean, in newspapers, I'm not using phrases like causal influence. It's too difficult to see religion, moving American foreign policymakers in one direction or another. And so some people haven't been convinced by my overall arguments, which is a perfectly legitimate criticism I think to have. The more interesting thing is that not so much in the reviews, but in radio interviews and other talking to people and giving book talks, just how politicized religion is. It's politicized, obviously, in how religion supports certain issues or certain viewpoints, but just that religion itself, if you're religious, it is supposed to automatically signify where you stand politically. Religion itself is politicized. And I'm amazed at how often people assume that I'm religious because I've written this book. I'm not. I'm not very religious at all. I have my own views on religion, but I'm not religious. And people are very surprised when they find that out, that I've written this book on religion. And generally, liberal audiences I've found are more, even though I would call myself a liberal, very liberal on most issues, including religion, liberal audiences have been more resistant to the book than conservatives. I mean, this weird place where I'm agreeing with conservatives, where conservatives are agreeing with me more than.
Is that because they really don't want to think that religion has such.
Right, exactly. Yeah, so that's almost always the consistent question I get from. So I did a radio show with NPR, and that's what the question is. Is religion really, it's presumed to be this kind of atavistic, pernicious force. Even though, as Obama himself has said, all of his heroes were religious, Dorothy Day and Martin Luther King and Malcolm X and people like that. These sort of radical left liberal social reformers came at it from a very religious perspective as well. That's kind of really lost in current contemporary American politics. I mean, end my answer there, because I could go on. I mean, I could go on and on and on, but it would lead me into American Kingdom. So, but in the interest of time, maybe we can talk about that later. Greg's very good question on Jesus. I hadn't thought about that. You're absolutely right. I mean, as soon as you asked the question, as you were asking it, I thought, he's right. Some leaders did talk about Jesus, but in a very non-Jesus-y way, I guess. Truman especially talked about Christ and the Golden Rule and came back. Truman actually quotes from Scripture more than most presidents do, including mentioning chapter and verse. And he knows it like that. He actually learned to read reading the Bible. And he read it time and time and time again. Even though he wasn't a fundamentalist. And he didn't believe it was literally true. It was his favorite book, and he read it every night. And he could quote. And so he mentions Jesus a lot, but again, just in a kind of Golden Rule way. His foundation for human rights and democracy is what we now call reciprocity. The Golden Rule, do unto others as you expect them to do unto you. Do no harm, that sort of thing. And he mentions that a lot. He mentions Christ, but not in that kind of way I think you're asking about this, Jesus. Eisenhower was very similar. Reagan, as far as I've been able to tell, is the only president who talked about Jesus a lot, or at least relatively a lot. And in his National Association, in his NAE speech, his Eagle Empire speech, he says something like, Michael might remember the exact quote, he says something like,
were enjoined by Christ Jesus to identify evil and resist it wherever it rears its evil head or something like that. I mean, it's very... And then, of course, he makes...
Which I don't know if that's actually ever said in the New Testament.
Well, no, probably not. Yeah, I'm not sure Christ actually does say that. And, of course, George W. Bush. I mean, that was the thing that was very shocking about Bush, is that all American presidents from Obama, you know, almost all American presidents, Thomas Jefferson was a little different, have spoken about God. And have spoken a lot about God, a lot about Christian, Jewish, Christian, Catholic, that kind of thing. But very few about Jesus, whereas George W. Bush was very upfront about and very open about talking about Jesus and not saying just Christ, and not saying the Son of God or the Lord, but Jesus. And it's very, because of his own faith, because he's a born-again Christian himself, a Southern Methodist evangelical. And that caused, you were right, this is how much controversy. Just the fact that when he was asked who his favorite philosopher was in the 2000 campaign, that he said, Jesus is my favorite philosopher. The fact that that was controversial shows just how, if he had said a book of the Bible, or if he had said Moses, or if he had said Paul, I'm sure it wouldn't have been as controversial. But there's something about Jesus that connotes a level of extremism or a level of devotion that a lot of people find uncomfortable. And I think that's why it doesn't pop up very much. In answer to, you asked a number of other very, very good questions. We could talk about more if we want later, but I want to move on to Zach's. I just say that religious sociologists, religious anthropologists don't really talk anymore about what people believe, because there's ultimately no way of knowing what people believe. Is Jesus, in that sense, how does it matter? Well, we don't know. All we can do is look at the manifestations of faith. And look at language and whether action matches rhetoric and that sort of thing. Methodologically, it's a very interesting point and a very interesting question. And of course, then it leads us into theology, which becomes even trickier, trying to link that to policy and to politics. On Zach's question, I stand by what I said about Kennedy's Catholicism. And I would, how do you measure it, I think, is how you ask it. It's a very good question. I haven't actually measured it in terms of measuring it, but intuitively, I was just thinking about it. Looking at the coverage, Romney's Mormonism gets coverage, but not that much coverage. And Kennedy's Catholicism was in the papers all the time in 1960. And Kennedy not only had to give his Houston speech to the Greater Ministerial Association of Houston, that's where he said, look, there are no religious tests for office. Don't vote against me. Vote against me because I'm a liberal, because I'm a Democrat, because I hold these views. Don't vote against me because I'm Catholic. Because I'm not going to, the fear was that he was going to take his marching orders from the Vatican. That was a very, very, very powerful idea in American politics and in American Protestantism. And I would say it was bigger than Romney's Mormonism because it transcended ideology. Liberal, very, very, very liberal, the Christian century crowd, very liberal Protestants, said they would not vote for Kennedy because he was a Catholic. I don't think many people are doing that about Romney today, and if they do, it's very, very quiet. The equivalent would be if somebody today wrote in Time or Newsweek or the New York Times that said, literally, I'm not going to vote for Romney because he's a Mormon. I think that is unthinkable. I can't imagine that happening today, whereas it happened all the time in 1960. Very reasonable people. People who were at the forefront of Martin Luther King's father, himself a civil rights campaigner later in life and a preacher, said he wasn't going to vote for Kennedy because he's a Catholic, because he'll take his marching orders. If it ever came where Kennedy would have to choose between the Catholic interest and the national interest, the American interest, he'd choose the Catholic interest. And a lot of these white, northern, very, very, very pro-civil rights, Unitarians and Methodists and Presbyterians, said, they called the Catholic Church ecclesiastical tyranny and that sort of thing. It was the last time in American politics where it was okay to be openly prejudiced. And unlike having sort of a thinly veiled, like Reagan in Philadelphia, Mississippi, or the Willie Horton ad in 1988. I mean, those are obviously racist, but it's not Reagan saying, I will protect you from blacks. Vote for me. I mean, that's how explicit it was about Kennedy's Catholicism, and that's why I would say it was more so than Romney's Mormonism today. People are a bit more cagey about it.
Salim.
Small challenge to the statement you just said about how 1960 was the last time it was okay to go to the Impressionists to talk on a religious question.
Oh.
About the so-called ground zero mosque.
Exactly.
Showing that it's okay to oppose Islam as Islam. You know, but the conservative circles, but nonetheless, the mainstream figures are. But that also just, it's a segue to a question, which is how you would figure Islamophobia into this whole framework. I know it's post-Cold War for the most part, but I'd just be interested to hear your thoughts on, on how that fits into this picture.
Yeah. Okay, Dina?
Yeah.
Seth?
My question is how you deal with separating ethnicity from religion. Mm. One of the things that I always come up with is how ethnic groups lobby on issues as religious communities, but also as ethnicities, and how do you just handle that from thinking about Cold War politics? Because there you could actually find a causal link in policy. Mm.
Okay, of course, I have so many hands, I'm only going to be able to take everybody, but Matthew.
I guess if there's one sort of iconic figure from this period that represents the attack on communism, it's John Foster Dulles. Mm. You said that historians got Dulles wrong on that score. It's a Marxist.
It's always good to plant in your own lecture a sort of an invitation for a question. Dora, you had a question.
You begin your talk with talking about how religion has not been looked at properly as a key factor in the Cold War, but if you look at Eastern European historiography on the Cold War, it's all about religion. So I was wondering if it's a particular Cold War history that you're talking about, of the American Russian or the American history that it's missing, because if you just think of Peter Kenny's article from Journal of Modern History, where he actually shows how Vincenti played a huge role in facilitating and speeding up the communist takeover with his ardent stubbornness. Yeah. So there's a lot of work on that, and also like in Poland, of course, toward the end of Cold War.
I think we're going to have to. Artemi's probably had his hand up for longer, so can we make that the last question? I know there are lots of others who want to get in.
Sorry, it was beautiful, although we're going to focus in on one specific thing you said about the Carter administration kind of not using religion, which was surprising to me on several levels.
Answers, otherwise we will run into even further out beyond the timetable.
Otherwise I'll also forget.
Yes, exactly.
I've been trying to write them down. Okay. You're absolutely right, Salim. What I should have said if I was being more careful is, as far as I can tell, the last time that in a campaign, in a sort of major national campaign or Senate campaign, where in a major instance like that where you could be openly prejudiced, you're absolutely right about the Ground Zero Mosque, which was neither at Ground Zero nor a mosque. And I was astonished at, I wasn't astonished at the prejudice, at the sort of bigotry of some people, but I was surprised at colonists and others who I normally think of as very level-headed and well-meaning, and how they could react at the reaction to this. I was actually caught by surprise by it. I think in terms of Islamophobia, I don't know if you agree with this, but what what I was surprised, I was living in the United States during 9/11. I was there for another 3 years. I actually moved to the United States on September 1st, 2001. And then I lived in the U.S. for 3 years. What surprised me was at the time lag in the Islamophobic reaction. So the Ground Zero Mosque, that idiot in Florida who was going to burn the Quran, a lot of the other examples are 2009, 2010. Yeah. There was a lag. I was expecting there to be this extreme backlash in 2001, 2002, and there wasn't. I know there were incidents. I know that some poor Sikh was beat up in Arizona because a Sikh man, because he was...
He got killed.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, sorry, killed. But I think, as far as I can tell, those were isolated incidents. There wasn't a whole lot of Islamophobia.
Part of Shelby Bush was actually very forthright in insisting that Islam was not the cause.
He called Islam a religion of peace and that sort of thing. Exactly. I mean,
it took a while for the anti-Islamic position.
I don't know why. I mean, my own argument, and this is from reading, this isn't based on my own research, this is from reading books and on the time, is that my own reading of Muslims in America is that because of the First Amendment, because the First Amendment, the separation of church and state, actually has allowed for this, religious scholars call it the religious marketplace in America, that you have the total separation of church and state. It's a totally deregulated religious marketplace. Nobody's controlling religion. There's no national church. There's no support for a national church. And so even in the days of Protestant hegemony in the 18th and 19th century, you still had religious pluralism that most places in the world didn't have. And that's not just where Jews could come compared to a lot of other countries, there's actually been very little anti-Semitism in America. Catholics were persecuted more than Jews were for a long time. But it's only in the United States that you could have things like Mormonism emerge, Seventh-day Adventism, Pentecostalism emerge. The Mormon case is different, obviously, but mostly free of government persecution, even though there's a lot of prejudice. And because of that, in surveys done in the 1990s and post-9/11, surveys of Muslim communities in the United States, especially immigrant communities, they were respected as people of faith. And they were respected as hardworking and so on and so forth. They showed far higher levels of satisfaction and of feeling American, feeling integrated into or assimilated into society, than Muslims in Britain, France, Germany, everywhere else in Europe. And what I find surprising is that there was no backlash right after 9/11. I find it surprising there was a lag. I don't know where it came from in 2009, 2010 myself. I don't know, maybe you have an idea on that. I can't say I have any answers on that. The meaning of being American, is that right? And your question was, I was trying to write it all down while we were moving along, but it was, does this, if I understand it correctly, were Americans so anti-communists because,
I wonder, today is very central, as we see.
There
is a political issue, so I'm wondering if this is a Cold War legacy, because
I see.
All this socialist claim in the end, but...
Yeah. I think it was accentuated, it actually began in the 30s and the 40s, and then it gets accentuated in the Cold War, and it's wrapped up a lot in the creation of this Judeo-Christian tradition. I'm not sure it's a legacy of the Cold War, because I'm not sure it was created in the Cold War. I mean, it was accentuated in the Cold War. But the link between American nationality and being religious, first being Protestant, then being Judeo-Christian, it's been very, very, very intimate. And it's been there, even people who weren't very religious, like Thomas Jefferson, believed that religion was very important. Tocqueville comments on it when he goes to America in the antebellum period. That's something that's very old, and I don't think it's new now. It's a good question as to whether it's at such a high level now because of the Cold War. I don't think the Cold War, I'm sure there's a relationship there. I haven't really thought about it in terms of linking it today, but I think you're probably right. Separating ethnicity from religion is a great question. Methodologically and theoretically, it's very difficult to distinguish. I try and be sensitive to that in the book, and I try not to look at it. I tried, in the interest of space and just my own capabilities, to limit it to people who were demonstrably religious to some extent, rather than, I say Henry Kissinger is obviously Jewish, but had, by his own admission, had almost no faith. I don't treat him as I don't look at his Judaism as it were. I do, however, touch on his Jewish ethnicity, his Jewishness, where I think it's relevant to Judaism as a faith. I'm not explaining this very well.
Well, I think you're speaking to the point about the politicization of religion. I mean, that's why the United States is different, because of the legacy of how ethnicity works compared to other places. And Kissinger's Jewishness meant other things than necessarily the faith.
Right. I think that's exactly right. And maybe, I'm sure in the book, or in other things I've written, I've got it wrong. I've got that balance wrong, or but I've tried to be sensitive to that context, to that as well. But it's a very important question. I've talked to people who would equate the two and see there's no point in separating them. Although if that's the case, then you'd have to talk about almost every American, even somebody who's an atheist, as religious because they're culturally Protestant. You know, they came from some sort of Protestant background. Sort of, you know, like my own, like myself, even like community, but coming out of a Protestant background. I've been shaped by Protestantism in some way, but I don't have faith myself. I've tried to be quite rigorous in that, but I'm sure I've got it wrong in places. Although I do talk about Christianity in the book. But I do talk about but the same is true for Catholics and Protestants as well. I think an interesting question is also the secularization of religious ideas. I refer to human rights, this concept of the dignity of the individual. David Hollinger at Berkeley is looking at human rights in a different way, looking at the secularization of the human rights idea from missionaries and religious NGOs to secular organizations like into area studies and universities, but especially the Peace Corps, Amnesty, Greenpeace. One of his basic questions is, it's a really interesting question, why is it that the human rights imagination explodes in the 60s and especially the 70s, at the same time that liberal Protestant missions almost collapse? And he said that impulse, that reformist impulse, that do-gooder impulse, switches generationally and switches from being based in the missionary movement to being based in human rights NGOs and environmental NGOs. And my chapter, I'm totally sold by his argument on that. I have a chapter on late 19th, early 20th century missionaries called Missionaries and the Imperialism of Human Rights. And I see them essentially as analogous to human rights NGOs today. They were campaigning against opium and foot binding and that sort of thing. And they were actually not doing, contrary to their image in most people's minds, late 19th, early 20th century missionaries in Asia and elsewhere did not do a whole lot of proselytizing. They built schools and medical clinics usually before they built churches. They did obviously preach the gospel, but they spent more time not preaching the gospel and basically campaigning for the right to set up schools for girls, because they said, I found it so surprising. You know, the big cause was education of girls. A lot of their rhetoric, say from 1895, to me, could be taken from, say, an NGO, a secular NGO in West Africa today, of educating girls, foot binding, female circumcision, that kind of thing. Anyway, I know I'm going off your question. It's a very interesting one, and it opens us up to a whole lot. Hollinger, yeah, H-O-L-L-I-N-G-E-R, sorry. I can talk after Jill about where he's published some of these articles. The book hasn't come out yet. On Dulles, we talk a lot about Dulles. I have a few chapters on Dulles. The way I think historians haven't necessarily got Dulles wrong, but they left something out. Dulles was a leader of the ecumenical movement. He was a very liberal. Some books describe him as an evangelical, because he was very religious, and he was, of course, extremely anti-communist. But he was a very liberal Presbyterian. He defended Harry Emerson Fosdick in the modernist fundamentalist. And Fosdick was a modernist and accused of heresy. And Dulles defended it in the 1920s in New York. Dulles was very liberal. He didn't believe in an inerrant Bible. He didn't believe that the Bible was literally true. He didn't believe in a virgin birth. He didn't believe in miracles. He didn't believe in a lot of, he was a very liberal, religiously very liberal. He's one of a dying breed. It used to be you could be very liberal religious and very conservative politically, or very conservative religious and very liberal politically. That, as Robert Wuthnow has told us, that's becoming less common. They're lining up, conservative religion, conservative politics, liberal religion, liberal politics. They're lining up now. Dulles is one of the last of those breeds. Dulles was a leader of the ecumenical movement, bringing religions together, especially bringing denominations together. Bring them under one roof. You bring different denominations that are swaddling Methodist, Presbyterian, Baptist, bring them together under one roof in the name of religious peace.
That's the Federal Council of Churches, the World Council of Churches. He took that model.
Protestantism?
Well, within Protestantism, and then the idea was, this is at a time of still anti-Catholicism, but the idea was then get the Protestant house in order, and then you can deal with Catholics, Orthodox, stuff. So eventually the Orthodox are brought in. Eastern Orthodox. So that, you know, you bring these different denominations together under one roof, the Federal Council of Churches, World Council of Churches, in the name of religious peace. He then took that model very explicitly in the 1940s and applied it, and actually Protestants had been doing that for 50 years, and applied it to international, his other passion, international relations. So if we can bring together denominations under one roof in the name of religious peace, we can bring together different countries under one roof in the name of international peace. And he, this was his model for the UN. And I asked the question, is it a coincidence that Dulles, often against his own party's recommendations, that Dulles was the one American who was passionately in favor of and a participant in helping set up the UN, NATO, the European community. These are essentially ecumenical solutions to international relations. He himself was very explicit about that. And that's a story historians miss entirely. I know we're running out of time. It's a very easy answer, very short. Yes, you're absolutely right. It was a very American-centric observation. And I take your point about the European literature, which is absolutely right.
Well, Andrew, many thanks. That was a tour de force, and I think the number of questions asked and the number of questions that would have been asked if I had allowed you all to ask as many as you wanted testify to how interesting that was. So that was great, but we need to move rapidly on to the coffee break. So many thanks.
Not have that. And you seem to be quite close to linking that
I don't have an answer, but I'm not sure that the Cold War here.
You mean that the Cold War explains the rise of the
addiction
of
the monsters?
It
doesn't. Why should this happen?
Why does it happen? That's a fair point. And to be honest with you, I don't make that argument in the book. I made it in this talk. Because I wanted to promote it. And I hadn't really thought about it in those terms until I was doing this lecture. I think the Cold War, I think from the 60s onward, which of course may or may not be a Cold War story, but I mean, Arden talks about this as a Cold War, this reaction to the high modernism in the 60s. And I think that has something to do with it. It's our disciple religion in a lot of large parts of the world, not just in the communist world, but elsewhere. I think that's something to do with it. And that's not necessarily a Cold War story. I mean, there, like, going back to your last night, really interesting panel last night.
Thank you. you haven't updated your PowerPoint, right?
No, I'm not going to use it.
You're not? Wait. Oh, yeah, you're not. That's not you. Sorry. Well, there's one other Latin American.
Yeah, yeah.
So we're done with PowerPoints.
Sorry.
So Michael, you don't have a PowerPoint.
Nope.
And... And then Jonathan, but I'm fairly certain he doesn't have one either.
Well, some people didn't.
It's good to see the panelists are ready, even if the audience isn't, but it's leave my 3 minutes sign for any other stuff. Yeah, I can agree.
Is our chair here or
No, your chair is Vanley.
Oh, I'm gonna
make certain that Vanley knows that remembers that he's agreed to. He was last seen on the phone, which is always bad news.
moment of this conference. We are tired, but let's try to keep
one more
focus on these wonderful papers, which deserve our attention. You know the rules, so let's see.